might be a good idea.
Okay, so welcome to Nerd Roundup. The nerds have already left on their horses. And we're going to catch up with the action already in progress. So we're talking about C++, and I said, hey, maybe I should actually be recording this. Bob, you're going to tell us a story about
this for an hour, goddammit.
Daniel, you're fading away to a ghost now.
I know. I said, help me, help me.
Daniel turned on the recorder and turned off his resolution.
I could have swore I hit the record button, and Bob was like, hey, you need to bleep out that last name. I looked, I'm like, well, hell, I don't even have a name. Heck, I'm not got anything.
So I revealed the secrets of the universe, and then I said, you must bleep.
Earlier we talked about a lot of really cool stuff. You guys probably sad you missed out on that.
We're coming at constructors from two different directions today, aren't we?
Yes. So we're talking C++ constructors, memory management, testing, all sorts of goodness in this article here that I liked. It was C++ constructors, memory, and lifetimes. And you were, James, I think we were talking about testing with assembly, and Bob was telling us a story from a previous client.
Oh, well, the idea is constructors. In C++, a constructor can generate hundreds of lines of code behind the scenes because there's just so much stuff going on in the constructor. And it turns out if you're not careful, you can cause real-time problems with that. And by the same token, you get massive amounts of code generated with a destructor because they have to undo everything that was done by the constructor. And I was about to tell the story of a client that James and I had years and years ago, and one of the programmers there had a real-time problem. And it was, she had a whole bunch of objects queued up that needed to be destructed, but she couldn't call the destructor if the destructor was virtual. Because it just took too long. And so she had to make it a non-virtual destructor, and then she had to delay the destruction and put it in an external loop and objects because it would have taken too long in the real-time window that she had. Very interesting problem. And, of course, it restricted the kind of objects she could use, because if you don't have a virtual destructor, then you don't get proper destruction of polymorphic objects.
There's a difference between construction and initialization, and a lot of coders just lump it all into constructor. And you know, if you've been down this road a few times, you end up writing an init function separate from the constructor that actually goes through and initializes everything.
Yeah, but so Bob, this is like before you must have been teaching single responsibility.
Oh well, I mean we looked at that and said, oh, this is really ugly. You know, first of all, it's not a virtual destructor, so it's not going to delete things properly.
Oh my God.
Second of all, we can't delete it at the right time. But she literally had 500 microseconds in order to get something done in the place where this had to be done, and the virtual destructor was just going to take too much time.
What in the great pumpkin's name was she doing that all of these things had to be released? And you remember?
Oh yeah, I remember exactly what it was. At Xerox, and they were trying to plan the sequence of operations in order to get a copy job done. And that sequence of operations consisted of a whole bunch of little tiny data structures. And those little data structures were things like turn on this motor at this millisecond time count, engage this clutch at this millisecond time count, and she'd have to create this long array of a plan. And then she'd have to send that plan to the individual devices, and the devices would say, ooh, I can do it or I can't.
And it was a tree, no doubt. It wasn't just a straight array. I'm sure it was like a tree or a hierarchical thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it was hundreds of data structures all linked together in a horrible tree, and she couldn't delete. When she knew that she couldn't do the plan, she had to delete everything, but she had no time to do it.
Extra processor for deleting objects, I guess.
Do you remember what that processor was, James?
Oh, I don't know. It was some kind of Motorola, I think.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, some 68,000 variant of some sort.
Yeah, it was a 68,000, had a 1 microsecond cycle time. We thought that was blazing fast.
Yeah, that would have been. That would have been.
And they did everything.
It's like Grandpa's tractor. Yeah, 1 microsecond cycle time. Hey, Grandpa, can we go for a ride on the 1 microsecond CPU?
Remember that one, James? They had they actually simulated the entire copier on the VAX.
I don't recall that actually working, though.
That was a very early...
the press release of the actuality.
Modern science. That was an off-target idea. You know, let's run our code off the target because we don't have a target.
What? Yeah, they didn't have the hardware.
We'll build a simulator because simulators are easy. That's fine.
Yeah. Well, you know, we do something different today.
Maybe.
Work with some guys that are doing cell phone simulators for similar reasons. Okay, so next up are three kind of joined articles of. I'm sorry, get smart. So next up, Bob, we're talking ray guns. Did you get a chance to look at these?
Lower the cone of silence, Chief. Yeah, I took a look at that article. All three of those articles. That was fast. I'd heard about that before.
Yeah, this is cool for a bunch of reasons. First of all, it's been going on, and everybody's been saying, no, it hasn't been going on. And now it's like, no shit, guys. This is really going on. There's something here.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad to not be a target. That didn't sound good.
Yeah, us nerds have been pushing back against this because it sounds kind of Buck Rogers-ish. And it's like, well, how could the microwaves just affect one person? And there are good ways of doing it. There's a reason they can use radiation to treat cancer in your body, for instance. They can cause it to converge at one point. I don't know why folks would be using these microwave. I don't know if they're using. One of the questions is it deliberate or not? Are they actually directly attacking people because they're important people, or is it just some sort of side effect of something else going on?
As far as I understand, there's no direct evidence of an energy beam. This is just one of the hypotheses, but it fits the story because it's just certain individuals at certain times, and the set of symptoms are similar. And the symptoms are headache and disorientation and dizziness and things like that. So somebody's come up with this idea that it's a directed radio frequency beam or a directed microwave beam. And I got to scratch my head over that because, you know, those energies don't get in about more than, a half a centimeter? They can't penetrate. So you can do some damage with them, but the damage is heat.
Well, yes, there's a wavelength. There's a wavelength of, depending on the wavelength, it sinks further and further into your system. Right? I don't. This is really bizarre because why would anybody use the? I think that maybe it's just a result of people using local microwave transmitters and just being some sort of confluence of, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Maybe.
How do you get that set of symptoms so precisely? With a beam that can heat up a certain bunch of cells close to the surface of your skin.
Well, the thing is what we're talking about, and this is kind of disgusting, is that people are effectively, it's almost like you stuck your head in a microwave. You're boiling the tissue inside your brain, basically.
Yeah, well, don't do that.
The symptoms. It's not as fun as you might think it would be, really. It's not a party thing.
So what's the evidence? Daniel,
there's CAT scans. I think the story started in the mainstream in Havana because our embassy employees were experiencing all sorts of weird symptoms that seemed to be related to one another. It just wasn't one person. There was all of them there, and now it turns out this is not just the embassy. It's other places, including perhaps Washington D.C. There is something really weird going on. But to Bob's point. Most microwave radiation just goes skin deep. Now you can move past microwave, I guess, to the gamma at that point. The very small wavelength microwave will penetrate.
Gamma rays. That would be, you know, if there's a directed gamma ray beam.
It's not going to be.
Let's get on Optimizer.
Like think so of the bandwidth we get, like a gamma ray, like, you know, internet connection finally.
Okay, so with Occam's Razor, I'm going to get my own theory out here. Cigars and rum.
Well, yeah, you drink enough rum in Havana, you can probably, you'll be seeing some microwaves too.
Walking by too, so it's like.
Yeah. Might be something to that, James.
And then Washington, D.C. is not much different.
It's Havana.
Yeah, the thing is, how do you know that there's anything different happening in Washington, D.C.? I'm not really sure what the test is. It's like, we have a bunch of weird people doing odd things. Okay, well, that's so far, so good. Next story is this cool little tool called Plant UML, and you guys probably haven't seen it. James. Okay. We're going to talk directed energy beam. I'm ready for the directed energy beam conversation, right?
That is phaser.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm not in my studio. I don't have my phaser with me.
And this has got the type 1 and type 2 thing where you can pull the type 1 off.
Can you pull it off? No.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, really? Oh, I can't take mine off. Oh, man, you got the handheld and the phaser.
Oh. It doesn't actually shoot people. It's the sad thing. I said, you figure for $18 you would have a real phaser, but it doesn't really shoot. So next we have this Plant UML tool, and this is cool for a couple reasons. First of all, it allows you to put your UML, if UML still lives for you, you can put it inside your rest of your code files, and it has a text format, so you can actually type in, you know, Bob. Alice, and it will translate these things into UML. So you can use version control to version control your UML diagrams. Now, like everything else, you know, like every freaking thing else, there's too much of this, and there's like just enough of this. This to me was cool because you can do maybe a 5 or 10 minute diagram to lock in with. You should be checking in whatever your documents are with your source code because documents change. This is a good place to put little sketches.
I was going to drop a C++ class into one of them and see what happened, but I got interrupted. Because the class diagram shows some, things like that.
I was surprised they had so many different diagrams. That's incredible. They've been doing a lot of work on this.
Well, you know, why not? It's something to take up your weekends, I suppose.
Well, yeah, UML, was it 34, 23 types of UML diagrams? A whole hunk of UML diagrams you can make.
And Bob, the state machine ones are compatible with the SMC.
Oh, really?
No, they're not. I made that up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, only in our business can you make things up. And oh, really? It's like...
We should, however, take a moment to pause and thank the people who started this idea of UML back and forth to code. And one of the guys who did that was Pete Code. And John Kern worked for Pete Code. So hopefully we'll see John Kern one of these days.
Yes.
Although Pete Code kind of gave up on it with Together J, the programmers he hired went off to found IntelliJ and JetBrains, and now they give us our best IDEs. So there's a nice history there.
That's lineage. Cool.
And there's a, you know, there's sort of a special feeling when you go too far with UML and various tools. If you've done, well, I mean, it's like it's sort of a happy joy. It's like, oh my god, and if you've ever done round tripping, you get that special like, oh, this is really, I can do anything here, and it'll be code automatically, it'll come back, and it's a happy feel. It's like when you believe in Santa Claus. It's like, oh yeah,
it's a lot like that. Yeah.
So here's Santa's gonna bring everything this year.
One of my clients really bought into rational rows and the whole round tripping you could do there. And they built this really sophisticated, I won't give them away completely, but they built these really sophisticated radios. And decades later, Rational decides we're going to discontinue it. You know, nobody was supporting Visual C++ version 6 anymore, which was what was under the hood. And so they're going to stop supporting it. And so they've got several million lines of this generated C++ code from diagrams
Somebody's got to maintain that.
Okay. Yep. And now they want to start learning programming again. Nobody could write a class from scratch. They had to draw a box.
Nobody could write a class.
You know, and I mean, this training class, and it's like, well, there's...
Well, yeah, but yeah, yeah, why would you need to write a class? You just have to write a few lines of code and the correct method that the model generates.
That's right. They were coding in these boxes. It was, well...
Think of the conceptual leap. We were just talking about constructors and static heap variables and all that stuff. And we moved to the complete other end of this, talking about, oh, you just draw the boxes and the code pops up. Think of just the distance between those two points. You've trained on the boxes and type into three lines of code, and suddenly you're in this other world. I don't feel sorry for those guys. I mean, I do feel sorry. It's got to be incredibly tough.
Well, the lesson is there that you never escape from the low-level stuff. No matter how you try to hide all the low-level junk behind boxes and arrows and whatever, you can't ever really escape from it. It's always still there. And it takes programmers to understand that. Yes. So might as well just...
I've had this ongoing discussion online with various folks where I talk about how simple a solution might be. And then they usually push back with, oh, okay, you're just some old cranky dude that wants to make things more complex. And that's kind of going back and forth. And I think that the best answer I have to that discussion is we programmers are good at abstracting things, even if we haven't abstracted them. So, I mean, the thing is, you can create something that looked like an abstraction, give it to some other guy, and he'll use it maybe fine for 90% of the time. And we're just stacked up about 7 or 8 layers of these like 90% little abstractions. And God help you if the 10% comes through, because then you're way down in the weeds again. We should do everything in machine language is what I'm trying to get with it.
I think binary. We should go back to binary, because at least then there's no ambiguity at all.
Hey, ask a question, get a 0 or 1. You can put it together. Just keep asking questions until you get the answer.
We wouldn't have to deal with those darn regular software releases as often if everybody had to program in binary.
That's true.
Yeah.
So next up is another like bodaciously awesome story. This one, I read this. I'm like, this has got to be fake. This just does not compute for me. If you've ever used a Dyson fan, they're bladeless fans, and they use this thing where the air pressure locally causes air pressure to move through the fan. They're really cool. And so these guys are like, you know, let's just build an airplane out of giant Dyson fans. And of course, they had a CAD program, so they made a cool looking diagram. And it's a cool idea. I just can't imagine working, though.
Well, I don't know why it wouldn't work. You do need a very high pressure source. And I don't know if you can generate enough pressure with an internal fan. But, okay, if you can get the airflow, you know. Do you have one of those little attachments? I have one to my air compressor. So I've got a little air compressor in my garage. And there's a little attachment you can put on the front, and it's just a tube with a couple of little holes in it. And you push high-pressure air through it, and low-pressure air just roars in from the sides and comes out and turns it into a leaf blower.
Oh, be dang.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
A tremendous amount of airflow can be pushed out from a very narrow, high-pressure stream.
Hmm. I'm not in doubt about the physics. It's the energy consumption and generating that kind of pressure and all that seems kind of wild.
Just to prove what, you know, know-it-all I am, that's called the Coanda effect.
Ah, yes, the old Coanda effect.
Coanda effect.
Oh,
which, by the way, is instrumental in airplane wings.
So Bernoulli would have something to say about it, probably.
Bernoulli is half of the problem. And then Coanda is the other half of the problem, if I understand it correctly, which I probably don't.
If you want to get in a lot of fun, start asking pilots why wings work, because it's something they seem to want to go on for. Is it Bernoulli? Is it there's this air pressure? Is it shape of the wing? It's does it fall through the air? It's a.
How does an airplane wing work? Well,
yeah. Well,
you know, you read the Wright brothers story. There's a book about the Wright brothers. It's really interesting because a lot of people had written about how flight would work before the Wright brothers started building their planes, and none of the ideas worked.
Well, they built the first wind tunnel, right? Didn't they build all this stuff, testing stuff on their own?
I don't remember a wind tunnel, but they built a lot of prototypes. and a lot of their vehicles didn't fly. You know. Oh yeah, I want one.
Iterative approach.
Yeah, this next story, this is really cool. Have you guys ever played around with lock picking as a hobby? Not as
no.
Not as something you learned in the pen. This is really cool. I bought a little kit for when we went on vacation a year or two ago, and you get a lock and a pick set, and it's quite relaxing. It's almost like knitting. Sit there watching TV and trying to feel the little pins, and it's quite fun. This guy spoiled all the fun because he's created a set of tools that teaches you how to pick locks.
And you know what's really fun about this article is you read it and you find out all the people that have tried to buy it, and it's already sold out. So expect your house to get broken into.
Well, locks don't. The first thing you learn is that locks don't do much of anything. They make you feel pretty good, I guess.
Well, you know, so it's like, should I get an electronic lock that can be hacked, or should I get a manual lock that can be picked, or what are the other options? Just stand around.
One of the options is to be armed. The use of locks at my house only serves to make a noise so that then we can have a conversation about why you're at my house. At
yeah, why are you in my house?
It's not going to be a fun conversation, but it's going to be a conversation. Yeah, because yeah, locks really
got into this hobby. And he would then carry a lockpick set around with him all the time. And it actually came in handy once. I can't remember what the situation was, but we had locked ourselves out of some place, and he just whips out his lockpick set and says, "I can take care of this." And zoop, 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 zoop. Within about 5 minutes, he had the door open.
It's a fun feel. We're talking about nerdy fun feelings. It is a really cool feeling when you bust. It's like, oh, wow, I did that. You're not supposed to. You feel like you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing.
Well. It's kind of true.
And then that guy comes out of the bedroom with a gun, and it's no good at that point.
Oh, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's a hobby. It's a hobby. I just stopped by. I want to know if you were interested or not. So the next article is this is one of a couple or three articles that I want to really learn more about, but I just don't have time. This is the constructor theory. I understand sort of the pop science version, they want to define the laws of physics based on what you can't do. So, I mean, you can't pull on Superman's cape, you can't spit into the wind, you can't mess around the old Lone Ranger, and you're not going to do, like, you know, temporal time travel or whatever. It's an interesting way of looking at things. I'm not sure how the math holds up. I don't know.
So the idea is an older one, at least in quantum mechanics, right? Because the early quantum mechanicists, is that how you say that word?
Quantum mechanics.
They realized that they could only define the way tiny little particles work by defining what they can't do and not what they can do. And the old saying was, anything not prohibited will happen.
And that was probably easier to agree on that than actually to end up with the probability waves that we finalized on.
So then you've got Feynman diagrams, right, that try to tell you why two electrons repel each other. And it's because the virtual photons can go all the way to the moon and back, violating the speed of light, but still cause the repulsion effect. As long as you can't detect those virtual photons going faster than the speed of light, it's okay. But they must exist.
Shut up and do the math thing for physicists. Yeah. It's like, well, it doesn't make sense, but just do the math. It all kind of works out okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, this is interesting to me because I've been doing this comparison between mathematics and science, right? And mathematics is a positive discipline. You prove things correct, right? But in science, you can't prove anything correct. You can only prove things incorrect. So it's similar to that. It's got that feel to it. And what she wants to do is just come up with all these anti-rules. These are the things that must never happen. Everything else can.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm coming at the same topic from semiotics and organizational management, and we try to describe systems of people in sort of mathematical terms. It's probably much better to describe them in negatives, right? People can't fly. People can't do this. You might get better traction working the negative space than the positive space.
So test-driven development. Test-driven development is a negative discipline, right? You can prove the software doesn't work. You cannot prove that it does work. Dijkstra wanted to prove that the software could work, right? And for the most part, everybody kind of gave up on that idea.
Well, what you do is you use test-driven development to create tests that then, using provable functions and formulas and coding, shows you that your human language assumptions about the problem are incomplete or incorrect, which feeds back to the person. You're supposed to reevaluate. Go up. If this is true, this can't be true over here. This is the photon question, but in application development. So
if photon goes here, to the moon.
You don't have to deal with the virtual photons because that gets the, yeah, you don't want to be in a virtual photon. Like there's, like here's a picture of me with virtual photons. No, it's no good. So But yeah, so the negative space thing looks like it would work. My concern would be how actually she's working the language of describing these things. That's kind of be weird.
It's a lot of not equal signs.
Well, we don't have a very good way of describing things positively in human language, much less negatively. I can take the same word with 50 meanings, so I don't know how the negative would work.
The internet is a great way of describing things negatively.
I don't agree with that at all, Bob.
I'm not going to say what you are.
If you want an argument, just get online. So somebody's angry about something. You just, hey, what are you guys angry about? Oh, damn it. Okay, thanks.
Someone out there said something I don't agree with.
I was feeling too happy. You guys help me out with this. Oh, you heard about the orphans that ran over with the bulldozer? Oh, that's good. Okay, I'm... I'm good. Thanks. I'm happy now.
Are you running?
My wife gets these news updates, and so we're sitting on the couch, and she goes, "Oh man, this kid just shot this." You know, it's just all these awful things that come out of her mouth at random times. It's like, oh, wow.
So, do you still have your bulldozer?
No, they won't. They won't let you. Actually, our neighbors got into a bulldozer fight. We live in the country, so we can't see the neighbors, and we get all sorts of folks here. Oh yeah, and it turns out our neighbors have some sort of chemical addiction problem that involves them staying up late at night playing loud music. And they got into a fight, and as we're wont to do in the country, we get their bulldozers out and start driving around. We're sitting there, like, all these police show up, and we've never seen police here at the house. So it's like four cop cars, and we're like, what in the hell? So we all go out and walk, and there's these bulldozers going. I guess they're trying to make a getaway at this point, and the cops pull them over, and it was a lot of fun, I guess. I don't know. 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, just don't show up with your lock pick set.
Well,
yeah. It's swept up.
Yeah, if he's coming through that door with a bulldozer at 2 o'clock, I don't know if my plan is actually going to work out well. Yeah. You can't fight no bulldozer. It just ain't working that way. So did you guys see this link about predictive coding approximates backprop along arbitrary computation graphs? I know when I see something like that, I'm thinking party time, buddy. This is like,
I started reading that abstract, and it was kind of like reading my son's PhD chemist abstracts for the articles he writes. It's like, I didn't understand what the hell they were talking about.
I got the words. I understand each word of this, but I have no idea what it's saying.
I had to come up with a working hypothesis because I have no idea, you know, what they're referring to here, other than, you know, it's neural nets, and neural nets send information in one direction. They don't have feedback loops. And so, you know, I think they're trying to say, well, if you add the feedback loops in machine learning, you can speed up the learning part of the neural net. And then the article goes on to say, but there's a way to not have the feedback loop but get the same results, which means that using this new technique, whatever this is, predictive coding, I don't know what that is, but using this new technique, biological creatures could get to the result the same way someone who had a feedback loop did. That's how I took it.
That's the general, and I'm probably wrong. The general conception I had, that you could actually grow outward from the bottom up instead of kind of coming down through a back propagation layered system.
So you don't need the back propagation, which is fascinating. You don't need feedback in order to learn.
But it's computationally,
I don't know, extreme,
it's exponentially more intensive than coming at the way we're currently doing it. Nature can make it work, because in nature you've got billions of trillions of organisms everywhere. It doesn't matter, but we're limited in resources, so we can't do it that way.
Like the feedback loop is kind of necessary, though, because what if some garbage got fed in, and then how do you purge it, right? The wrong ideas or whatever, how does it get purged out if there's not some feedback loop?
That's good. Oh,
you have a nerd brain.
They're very strategies. There's the training data, and there's actually it involves little bulldozers that kind of go around.
It's the bulldozer theory of forward propagation.
Have you ever thought about just giving a total bullshit lecture on your class? Like, computational theory from the Marx Brothers. It's like,
Oh my god. Did you see the or hear the about the guys who did exactly that? They would do Markov chain papers. Yes. They just randomly generate papers and then submit them to journals and get them accepted.
Because there's somebody, some editor going, no, I don't know what, for all intents and purposes, this is what we're doing with this thing. It's like, oh, it kind of looks like it might be like this.
it's a really old thing that people have engaged in. My father, when I was a teenager, my father handed me a research paper about the supersonic bird. It was called the Eornis, and they used a lot of German words in there. I think I remember one, Eornis Geschlechtheit Differenzi Rundskunde. That was in there, right? And so it must be very serious. And they took pictures of it, and they had all this graphs and research. And it turns out that the picture was the hood ornament from an old car. But they got this paper out there and accepted. So, people have been working that for a long time.
That word sounded like the German translation for Cronus and Classic Infundibulum.
It's just what I was thinking. I know there was a Scott Adams, the guy who draws Dilbert. He did something, what was it, with a Bay Area company where they showed up and did this ridiculous training session, and they videotaped it, and people were like, oh, yeah, it looks pretty interesting. Yeah, this really gets at it. One of the reasons I actually love doing this sort of organizational learning, the pivot between coding and org stuff, is because, like, on one side, you have provable programs. It's like, yes, this works, does not work. We grok this, right? On the other side, you have, like, better organizations through origami or something. It's like, you're like, what the hell? And motherfuckers, I'm sorry, but some of this actually works. It's like, how did they do that? You can do origami. It turns out you can do origami and, like, run a multinational company off of that. Who knew? So it's interesting to me because it doesn't always make sense.
By the way, the Google captions completely ignored your sentence with the foul language. It had bleeped you out some other stuff, some other things.
Son of a bitch. I didn't know it did that.
Oh, there you go.
I didn't know.
It only bleeped off the B-I.
We're all kind of fathers here. Do you have rules about profanity at your house?
Yeah, I get to swear. Nobody else does.
Seriously? Fuck, that's not right. How about you, James? You guys are...
Yeah, we generally try to avoid it. And I got in trouble at Object Mentor. Remember, Bob, how I got in trouble at Object Mentor?
No, I don't recall.
We're at one of the XP immersions. We had 60 people there. And two of our esteemed guys, Alan Francis and Mike Hill, were screaming or talking to each other from across the room at every other word in their vocabulary at the time, including F-bomb. And I know that our wives were working the kitchen for this event. And Mary Lee said to me, James, they sure are use the F word a lot. And one of the people in the crowd also complained. And then at our stand up the next morning, I mentioned it. And then from then on, I was labeled the prude of Object Mentor.
Oh. you got him reversed because you were trying to get. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Alan Francis, LSF. Not going to tell you what that stands for.
No, the middle is, he's little and it's Scottish.
Yeah, a little Scottish.
LSF. Our rule was we don't use profanity because it's a poor man's way of expressing yourself. But once somebody brings up some profane word and anybody acts prudishly at that point, then it's open season to overuse as many profane words as you want for the next few minutes or so until we get all out of our system. And we move on. It's work. That seems to work for us.
Yeah.
But I guess everybody's got their own damn way of doing this.
Yeah.
As it should be.
As it should be. Next up, UVA researchers find yet another Spectre problem with Intel processors. And this made me sad. Intel, you've coupled too much stuff in that chip, and now people are going to exploit the hell out of it probably the next 20 years or so. Yeah, it's just Intel early on went to sort of a side-by-side architecture where they do the predictive stuff, which everybody's doing predictive, but Intel wanted to do side-by-side too. Well, it turns out those side-by-side channels are not completely independent of one another, even though they're advertised as such. And so you can kind of come into one CPU lane and make it really busy and affect the other lane. And that can do all kinds of bad things to your security model. Yeah. Not
so
fun.
This is really weird, right? And you see this in a whole bunch of other different disciplines too. Somebody adopts a strategy to moderately improve performance. You know, the predictive execution of instructions that might be executed but might not, depending on some upstream branch. Okay, but we're going to go ahead and execute those instructions anyway because it'll be fast.
Just in case.
We might be able to get ahead of the game. Well, and then, of course, while this machine is executing these instructions that aren't actually going to get executed for real, it's not paying attention to the security stuff.
Yep, and now all of a sudden you've got someone's password or encryption key sitting in the pipeline, right?
Yes.
Ready to go.
How often do we see this kind of stuff? You know, so some guy creates a buffer of n size and just doesn't worry about the fact that the string coming in might be n plus one, and then some hacker comes in and says, "Ooh, the n plus one character just happens to be a jump that will jump me into the supervisor. I'm going to figure out how to do that."
It used to be that mail servers, you could send an email to a company and they would say, "I'm sorry, we don't have a user by that name." Like, oh, okay, well, I'll try somebody else then. Cool. Well, I can keep banging away at this thing till you give me all the email addresses. This is pretty easy.
So there was a document written in the early 60s, way, way back. It might even have been the late 50s, about passwords. Right? And it said, first of all, don't give the person typing any clue at all as to the size of the password. You know, don't abandon it at 20 characters, right? Just let them type. Let them type anything they want and ignore everything they do. Give them no information at all. Nobody paid attention to that. You know, it's like every time you type a password, oh, I've gotten to the 15th character. Oh, it bailed out. That password is too long. That username is too long. So they give you all this information. And then in the same document, they went on to say, look, if you wanna have a password that's really good, choose two words from your native language, separate them with a space. Just two random words.
Random words, yeah.
Two random words, and you know, just use regular letters. You don't need capitals. You don't need numbers. You don't need dots. Pick two words.
And that was the answer right there in the 60s. That was the answer.
That was the answer. It's, you know, I'm not going to say that's what all my passwords are.
I don't know my passwords. I have no idea. I use a password manager and I get this 24, you know, character thing that I could never remember at all. It's just random characters.
Yep. I make mine up, but they're all different. But I use a password manager too, so.
Well, nowadays you have to do that, but.
You have to. Yeah.
Information leakage is fascinating. They did this thing with touch typists So you could have an app on your cell phone. For instance, I have my cell phone next to my computer. It could be listening to me typing as a touch typist. And as I go to type my password, the delay between the keystrokes can actually tell you which keys I'm using to type the password in. Wow.
That would never work for me.
The finger. You do the hunt and peck kind of?
I use all the fingers, but in a very...
What do you do? Like wave your hand around? For... Hey, it's pasta.
I think Jim Newkirk said it once. He goes, I never have to worry about getting carpal tunnel disease the way I type because it's not repetitive.
I can type really fast. I don't type anything that makes any sense, but I can make the keyboard just my error rates are quite high.
I was astounded to watch a secretary once do two-finger typing at really fast. Yeah. I don't know how fast, but it was really fast. I couldn't.
My son has learned two-finger, and he really flies with it. He's codes all the time, which is really great. So next up is this Unix Magic poster, I think from the 1970s. And if you guys see this link in the comments, I've got the huge version. It's a 25 meg PNG.
Yeah, did you download this?
It took forever to download.
45 seconds.
Oh, yeah. Saw this, I'm like, I gotta have it. No.
I did a speed test on my computer. It's like something's wrong with my computer. So I did a speed test, and I'm getting 800 megabits per second download, and this thing still is just creeping along. They must not have a very big pipe on their end.
Well, everybody went. They got slammed, I think. So this is a poster for Unix, and it's got at least 40 Easter eggs that I can see or people told me about in the poster. So I don't want to spoil a lot of them, but it's a wizard in his room doing wizard things. And, for instance, one of his buckets is labeled null, and one's labeled awk. And so the more you look at this thing, if you know Unix, the more fun it'll be just sort of finding all the Easter eggs.
I roamed around in it for a while, and I saw a few of them. I didn't have a lot of time, but I figured that it's such a high-resolution image that there must be some really clever pixel-related Easter eggs in there. So I haven't looked through it, but it might be interesting to spend 5 hours looking.
Well, there are people who enjoy playing games like that. So some of the bags on the wall are Spawn and Dates and Root. And like I said, the more you look, the more you find.
You're less than a star.
If you look carefully, you can find a leak.
Oh, that's a leak.
It's a memory leak.
Oh, it's not pouring out of his head, though.
there's some pipes at the top there.
Pipes?
Oh, my God, geez. Oh, pipes, of course. But of course. Oh, wow. Somebody took a lot of time with this.
What's the bucket? What's the bucket?
Oh, there's a T.
And that's a shell.
Oh, that's
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Okay. So yeah, we could do this for a while. Got two more left. And the two more left are sort of military related. The reason I include them is because the military always ends up kind of going through these pains before we do. And this one is that whenever you show up anywhere with any kind of electronic gear, you're actually sort of, you have a signature. It's not just that you're emitting EMF everywhere because you're leaking. You're emitting a certain kind because you have a cell phone and a night vision goggle, whatever you're carrying with you, sort of fingerprints you for the rest of the universe. Yeah, that sucks.
So one of the interesting things in this article was and they just said it on as an aside, but there was a disclosure of some secret barracks in Syria, was it, or somewhere?
There was the barracks, and there was the plane they used. And
yeah, it was, so the barrack, I think it was the barracks, or maybe it was a fort or something, that they were able to discover because the people there were using the Strava app to watch their fitness. You know, on your watch or on their phone, and then people were able to look at that and go, oh, I know where these guys are.
We vacationed in Australia a while back, and there's a place in Australia where if you go on the tour, they say, well, here's the secret CIA base that we're not supposed to tell you about. There's a TV show called Pine Ridge, if you're interested. It's all about the secret base you're not supposed to talk about. But they had the same problem because they were using fitness apps, and you can just go in and see where everybody is around the base, and you can sort of deduce where all the things are, what's going on.
So the one they're talking about, the subject of the article, was a special forces op.
Yes.
Which was successful. But all of their tactics and everything was revealed shortly thereafter by just a bunch of hackers who were looking around at the various signatures.
And some of the stuff was actually, if I read it correctly, was revealed in real time, because people who track airplanes that take off and land, and they were actually on the web while this was happening saying, oh, okay, this looks like this may be a special forces op. And thank God it wasn't the people on the other end of the op reading that. Yeah, messed up.
They're watching now, though.
Well, they are, but you can't watch everywhere. So it's it's a what they call a peer adversary is the one you want to worry about. That's the that's really the Chinese and Russians. But we just say peer adversary to be nice about so we don't actually say that. It's interesting. Then the last one here is a countermeasures for secure communications article. This guy had done a paper. And he's all about what do we do to like prevent these EMF signatures being picked up. And I thought this was really interesting because one of the things we can do is use ultraviolet light, because the atmosphere is impenetrable to certain forms of ultraviolet. It's just like it only goes so far. It's the same as the microwave problem we had earlier. So if you could, for instance, have an LED on your helmet that flashes ultraviolet light and communicate within a kilometer or two, and nobody else could see it because physics, you just can't see it. It doesn't work. It's cool stuff.
I thought that was neat. And they mentioned lasers. They said, well, you can also keep people from knowing that you are communicating if you can get the beam narrow enough.
Yes.
And the UV one was you can keep people from knowing that you are communicating within a certain radius or outside of a certain radius because of the UV extinction. Right. And so the article just went on to different levels of saying, well, now sometimes it's okay if they know you're communicating as long as they don't know what you're saying.
Yes.
Right. And so it took it from level to level to level. And what was the title of the article? It went on to talk about great powers. Or maybe that was the previous article. Hmm. And maybe the previous article was the great power competition, which I thought was a very weird thing to add to that. Yeah, the previous one, that's right, because it was special forces and then great power competition. Mm.
There are two kind of parallel stories here, both of which are like extremely nerdy and both of which we don't talk about. The first one is electromagnetic radiation is something we've tried to ignore as coders and as the press, and it's just, we're not going to be able to do it anymore. The stuff like, where are microwaves? What kind of way are you communicating? It's going to hit certainly the average Joe already. And then the second one's even more wild, which is we're basically in a state of war right now, have been for some time, with these other great powers. It's just a matter of how public they want to make the warfare. And that's far out. That's not a good thing, I don't think.
Well, you can always say that to some extent, competing nations are always in a state of war. It's just, you know, is it a hot war? Is it a cold war? And is the collaboration balanced by the conflict? You know, are we more collaborative than we are conflicting? But there's always some element of struggle there. And of course, if that element gets too great, then we have a real war.
The old saying was back in the day, Stalin was
out of whack, right? You know,
yeah.
So.
Stalin, they always said that you had one guy. So whatever the rules were, you could look to the Soviet Union. There was that one guy who was making the rules. So you could kind of reason about that. We're working with now we have non-state actors, a lot of hackers that states are using. And so there's no one guy anymore. So it's sort of I'm interested in where those lines are of this is too far. And I haven't seen that. I mean, at some point, I'm sure we already have kinetic warfare happening around nerdy stuff. Cody.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read what was it? The one guy in Special Forces said that they want to take people with Raspberry Pis or coders and put them as Special Forces. Imagine a bunch of like nerds with like pocket protectors and slide rules. It's like, whoa, that's a whole different skill set. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, they did a lot, a big deal about that with, remember the show 24?
Yeah. Sure.
What a great show. Right? But one of the major characters was a hacker. And they would talk about how they were going to be data mining things and constant jargon. But the idea that deep techies will be involved with warfare is decades old now.
Yes. And I wonder, you know, the Marines, one of the stories I've been tracking is the Marines are completely refactoring their service model because it's going to be in the Pacific, and they're getting rid of the entire tank corps of the Marines because they don't think they're going to be fighting with tanks. I wonder if a strategy wouldn't be just bring an EMF weapon, EMP, just wipe everything and go back to basics, and then nobody has any tech. Seems like there's probably some traction there, you know?
Most world dies with that one because you can't get food to New York City. Oh, yeah.
Well, you can do it locally. You don't have to, you know, do a nuke at 100 miles. You can do, they make small EMP weapons.
And you think that'll be okay? No refrigerators? No.
I think it beats getting your ass kicked, actually. If I was on an island somewhere in the Pacific and they were getting my ass kicked, I'd pull the plug pretty sure, pretty quick.
How do you do a local EMP?
Well, it's the Earth. It's the nap of line of sight stuff. The EMPs don't go through the Earth. Same thing yet again with the microwave thing. EMPs don't go through the Earth, so you're just shooting it depending what the terrain is.
So you'd have to do like a great big capacitor dump or something, right?
You were talking about how you physically do it. Yeah, it's an explosive. I think you send a magnet through a loop of wire, I think so, at the capacitor.
Okay, yeah, you could do that, I suppose. You know, or you run a massive current through a coil and then you cut that current off rapidly. Or you fire a really powerful magnet through a coil or something. I suppose you could do that. Or a big capacitor dump. And anything that has, enough of an EMP edge, an electromagnetic edge that could spread out for a radius of a mile or two, then how easy is it to shield against that?
Well, that's the thing. And have they actually shielded? Because I've heard differing stories over whether or not the gear is shielded or not. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But it would seem to me that if you surround something with a conductor, anything inside that area is just not going to feel the pulse.
Make a little, what's it called, Faraday cage?
Yes.
Like an
aluminum foil, microwave, yeah.
Like an elevator.
Yeah. Elevator, yeah. Yeah. But I guess it would be possible to make a repeating EMF weapon, so as soon as you come out of that Faraday cage, you're just going to zap your electronics thing.
And people nearby will get strange symptoms of dizziness and headache.
Oh, and we've looped all the way back around to the regular. Yeah, it would be a lot of unpleasantness involved. Okay, so we're out of time here. Let me do this. Where are we at here? This is that. Here, guys, we have this field. We have a duck. This is our goodbye. Let me do the goodbye thing. You've wasted yet another hour. Instead of learning C++ or doing exception handling or anything you could have done useful with your life, like your mother warned you, you're instead online watching people tell you jokes. Thanks for coming by. I'm happy to have you. Please come by again. I'm Daniel Markham. I will see you on the internet.